right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we have a small, intimate conversation. Brought back our good friend, John Hamer. John, welcome back to Mormon Expression.
Thanks, John. I'm glad to be back.
It's good to have you. And it's just going to be you and me tonight. No punchy sidelines from Zilpha. John, you and I were talking recently. There have been things that pop up from time to time. We call them on the LDS side faith-promoting rumors, of things about the Community of Christ, of course, used to be called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah. I mean, these kind of things circulate all the time, so go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I want to take tonight and sort of go through some of the most common ones and either dispel or confirm the myths, the ideas that Salt Lake City Mormons tend to have about the Community of Christ.
Great. Hit me with anything you got, and we'll try to answer as frankly as we can and dispel, or when we're unfortunately necessary, confirm.
and I want to start with one that I just saw pop up just a couple days ago, and I brought you in on the conversation. And I think this is one that bounces around quite a bit. It has to do with the temple in Kirtland. Of course, we've done a podcast on that. That temple is owned by the Community of Christ, and there's always these rumors about. I've heard them both ways, that it's about to be sold to the church, the church's in negotiation, or that the dirty Community of Christ people are holding out, and they're going to hold out to the bitter end, and God is going to put his wrath on them and eventually hand it over to Salt Lake.
The second one, we're going to hold out to the bitter end.
No,
this is one that happens all the time, and in fact, when you brought me into this, on a couple bulletin boards, I guess, on the Blogger Knackle and some Facebook pages, people had brought this rumor back. Great sources, close in, and the upper ups or whatever, have said that they're in. There's negotiations, and the Community of Christ is about to, the Community of Christ, we're on the verge of bankruptcy, so therefore we're going to sell the Kirtland Temple to the LDS Church, and so those circulate constantly. So I wrote, that particular myth comes back again and again and again, and you can understand. I can certainly understand why Mormons would like to have that happen. So in other words, this is something that would be, it's a wishful thinking kind of a myth, but it is never going to be the case, and it has never been the case. It never will be the case. And I can confirm again for this time around, that this is not the case. So I actually, periodically, just so that, so I had a reporter contact me and ask me if this was the case based on this, again, the circulation of this rumor. When I had about six people ask me this week, because of how the rumors are circulating, then I feel okay. I feel obliged. Okay, well, I'll ask again. So I called the director of historic sites, who's in charge of the temple in Kirtland and the other historic sites, Joseph Smith's grave, all those kind of places, and he confirmed that under no circumstance that this is not happening, and under no circumstance will it ever happen. The same thing, previously this story has circulated, a friend of mine, Steve Shields, who's a historian of, Mormonism and of all of the schismatic groups within Mormonism. So he's fielded this rumor. So when maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago, he tells a story where having heard it, he heard it enough times that, okay, he was always saying no, no, no. But anyway, he bumped it up. He actually talked to Grant McMurray, who at the time was secretary to the first presidency. So Grant went, he later ended up becoming, president of the church. But Grant, went and asked the first presidency. He came back and he told Steve, I can tell you the answer, and I'll give you a direct quote. The answer is, hell no. So I think that this is one of the ones that can be on the church's webpage. So
I can't imagine how that conversation would go down. Ring, hey, this is Salt Lake. What's up, guys? You know that
you guys
temple?
Want to ever sell that? I'm thinking of selling that. You know that temple you have? Because we were kind of thinking of, you know. And so, the thing about it is, just to explain. So the background for this this myth is that obviously the LDS Church is well known for being super wealthy. The LDS Church has lots of money. It can blow billions of dollars on malls in Salt Lake City or whatever it wants to, it wants to buy a mall or whatever. So it may be the buyer's amount, between them and maybe billionaire Mormons, the buying price for something like the Kirtland Temple is it's $1 billion or something like that. So in other words, it's an insane amount of money on the demand side, but on the other side, the ownership side, Community of Christ, the RLDS Church, is not a rich church. It never has been. The church doesn't have the same idea of tithing, which is 10% of gross. The idea in Community of Christ of tithing is 10% of increase, which is to say the amount of money that you have at the end, having paid all of your expenses. Well, nowadays everyone lives check to check, so obviously increase isn't as much as it used to be. So the result is that the church doesn't have a lot of money. But on the other hand, the church does have lots and lots of assets. It's a very well endowed church. We don't have, we don't have an incredible amount of money in our operating budget. We do give out financials, so we don't keep our finances secret. So people look at them and they say, "Wow, those guys, they don't have, they keep on saying, hey, we've received this much tithing. We hope everybody will give, this much more in the next quarter," that kind of thing, because we have make our reports open. And then a lot of times everybody in the memberships, is rallied to that, and then they give the money or whatever. But the result of it is it make people see, this as a financial problem, and they imagine that this asset will be sold. But the reality is that the church has, is very property rich. So there are thousands of churches in downtowns, and there's hundreds of campgrounds, for example, where the church in the Community of Christ, there's a rich tradition of holding reunions at campgrounds. And so there's all kinds of property that's owned. The church has no need to, I've talked to the head of the person who's the chief financial officer of the church. He said very clearly to me, the church has no problem in terms of money. That there's the problem is just in the operations. So this will never happen. I mean, I can just confirm it a thousand different ways. So.
So, in doing a little bit of research for this, I went and looked at some of the official stories of that. And, it dates back to, if you read like the church manuals, the seminary manuals, they'll talk about the temple falling into the hands of these sort of, unclean apostates. Maybe it's because this is such a powerful narrative, it's worth kind of briefly going into how did the Kirtland Temple end up in the hands of the reorganized church as opposed to the Salt Lake branch?
Right. So when the Utah Mormons decided to leave the Midwest, the Utah Mormons left. So the people who stayed, the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons who stayed in the Midwest, were in a lot of cases divided amongst a lot of different churches. So there were many competing factions. There were lots of competing leaders, but there were lots and lots and lots of Mormons who stayed in the Midwest. When people say the vast majority of Mormons left, what they mean is the vast majority of Mormons who actually lived in Nauvoo. But at the time that Joseph Smith died, it should be remembered that the majority of Mormons did not live in Nauvoo. They lived in little branches that were scattered all around the Midwest, or they lived in branches in England or all kinds of places like that.
Wasn't it Martin Harris that said, "I didn't leave the church left me"? Or maybe
that's absolutely, Martin Harris is absolutely right about that. In fact, for his case, that's even long before, in his statement, that's long before Joseph Smith's death, right? So for Martin Harris had signed up for what was a very completely different Mormon church than the Mormon church that left him and moved to Missouri. So he stayed in Kirtland. He stayed as mainly he ended up being the custodian of the temple for a whole long time. Essentially, there was always whereas Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon and some of their loyalists left Kirtland, in order to escape their debts in 1837, 1838, a whole group of Latter-day Saints continued to be in Kirtland continuously. And people, sometimes in an organized fashion and sometimes not, they would occasionally, whenever there was an organized group of Latter-day Saints, they would continue to meet in the temple in Kirtland. So there was always a community of Latter-day Saints that continued to be in Kirtland Temple. Sometimes they were in communion with Nauvoo. Later groups were in communion with James Strang's church in Voree and Beaver Island. And then ultimately, the Latter-day Saints that were in Kirtland decided that the person who was Joseph Smith's successor was his son, Joseph III. And when that happened, they transferred their title, you know, their claims to the title, to the temple, which they've been in possession of it, they transferred it to him. And so the point is that the title wasn't clear then throughout the 19th century, because in fact, you know, when Joseph Smith fled town, the thing was in, the church was bankrupt and the title wasn't clear. But anyway, so by the time the end of the 19th century, the Community of Christ, the RLDS Church, had had possession of it. It had maintained it. It had re-roofed the building and everything like that, so that the building survived. You know, it would have been just ruined by now, and it wouldn't. I mean, it's a very old building. It wouldn't exist if it hadn't been maintained. And so it had been maintained, and the taxes were being paid. And so at that point, the court ruled that the church had clear title to it. So the church has clear title to it and has ever since the late 19th century. So
and sort of sum up, I mean, since the time Joseph Smith fled in the middle of the night, there's been a continuous congregation around it, and it just sort of grew and went to where it is today.
There's been Latter-day Saints there. Now whether they weren't always meeting. So whenever anybody would come into town, they would get excited, they would reorganize. So James Strang went there, and they reorganized a Kirtland stake. And so, like a lot of the old guys who had left the church, for example, over the collapse of the bank when all the problems that arose around the bank and all those things, those guys came back in. They were made high counselors in Strang's stake and a stake president and all that kind of thing. So in other words, and then there would be local leaders like Zadok Brooks, who, you know, would be like the head of his own kind of Mormon church that was based in Kirtland. So in other words, they were always there. They weren't always organized. They weren't always meeting, but there were always a group of Latter-day Saints there. And then by the end, you know, of the 19th century, the little local group that was meeting as a congregation, that congregation affiliated with the reorganized church.
All right. And you can go to the temple today, and I still haven't been out there. I need to make my way out there, but it's open to the public.
You can go. You won't post this in time, but I'm going to be there this weekend for Sunstone Kirtland.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
Yeah, you can definitely go to the temple. It's open to everybody for tours, and it's also the church, the Community of Christ. The Community of Christ. Anyway, the Community of Christ is, I think, does a very nice job of understanding that this is an important sacred space for everybody, all of our cousins in the movement. And so it's open for devotionals, for, let's say, LDS stakes, for Strangites, I have gone there, for members of the Remnant Church, anybody, you know, who is a Restoration, Latter-day Saint heritage, you know, they can come and visit this sacred space and hold devotionals and things there. And then also it's obviously a site of pilgrimage, a site for tours. And so it's, and then there's, you know, we also have there, you know, to show kind of, I guess, another thing about not selling. I mean, we very recently have invested, you know, millions of dollars to build a brand new visitor center and museum, which houses a lot of important Kirtland era artifacts there for visitors to go see. So it's a great place to go.
And lest anybody charge that it's being defiled in such a manner, that's the way that it was at the time when Joseph Smith was there. It was open to public.
Open to tours always, yeah. In fact, yeah, way back when Joseph Smith was there.
Okay, so as long as we're talking about temples, let's talk about the Missouri Temple. Now you guys are rolling out this new Seekers program where you're trying to, I think, open the faith up to those who might be, more liberal in their Christian views, or those who might be fleeing from the mainstream church. Maybe a sentence on that, since I brought it up.
Yeah, so there's a program. So for the past while, especially the most recently in the past half a decade or so, a lot of people in the Restoration tradition, ex-Mormons, liberal Mormons, have decided for whatever reason that they aren't able to stay in the LDS church or whatever church that is their tradition, and they have become kind of as investigators to Community of Christ and thought, well, what are those guys doing? I've heard about them. They're this liberal church. How does that even work? I don't even understand what, I've heard all these things about them. They're Protestants or whatever it is, and they want to find out more. And so as a result, and in response to that, Community of Christ has created this program, which is called Latter-day Seekers. And the idea of it is, how can the church be open to seekers who are looking? What can we do to provide a spiritual home for people who are interested in maintaining Latter-day Saint tradition heritage, but maybe aren't wanting to have, are interested in a more progressive church, but have this and that thing that we haven't maintained in Community of Christ that they maybe think is still important, and can they still do that in a Community of Christ congregation? And so the program is set up so that, one, we can kind of explore all the possibilities between investigators and the church, and then also that there's this kind of a two-track option, which are, one, how can people immediately find Community of Christ congregations, and can we have the congregations be understanding and open and not be dismissive of things that are alien to Community of Christ people? So how can we educate it to our own people? And then two, is it possible to set up emerging congregations, is what we call Community of Christ, but essentially what I call them a Utah Rite branch of the Community of Christ.
Yeah, the reason I bring that up is that there's an ad campaign, and it covers some of these myths, kind of like we're talking about. And one of them starts out and says, why isn't there a church? Why isn't there a temple in Independence, Missouri? And the answer is, well, there is one. of course, you all have constructed a temple there on what may be the temple lot. So there's some controversy as to whether or not who really has the place that Joseph Smith set aside.
I can tell you about that then. Yes. So the temple lot, nowadays is sometimes just associated with the 2.5 acres of land that is owned by the Church of Christ temple lot, which is a completely different church than the LDS Church of the Community of Christ.
Do we know where the cornerstone was? Do we really know?
They have the traditional spots.
Okay.
So no, we don't know. They have, so the answer is they dug up, when they did an excavation, when they were going to try to make a temple, which didn't end up happening, when they dug down, they found stones which they believe are cornerstones. This is a faith claim for them. but this is not something that historians agree with them about. So in other words, this is something that I'm not saying that, anyway, this is what they believe. It's part of their beliefs, and not, going to denigrate them, isn't part of our beliefs, and it isn't part of historians' beliefs. But anyway, so it's a traditional spot. The spot that they have identified, is as good as any we might know. So this is as good as any traditional spot. Essentially, when they came back, they were the first to come back after the saints were driven out of Jackson County. No one was there until they came back. They received a revelation to come back, and they did first, in their church. And so when they did, there were people that were still alive. Now, the whole area who had remembered, and now not in their church, but who had remembered, but in Independence, who had been able to point out this is the spot or whatever. Now, the town, though, had changed an awful lot, so who knows? So, but it's the best possible guess because they had access to local informants that are now dead. So, but we don't know for sure. No. So the answer is we don't know for sure. What we do know for sure is that we know the larger parcel, which is around 70 acres, of land, which Edward Partridge purchased on behalf of the church. He was the first bishop or the first financial officer, of the original church, and he purchased that land. That land was going to be the center of the proposed city of Zion. And in Joseph Smith's two plans that they made for the city of Zion, the plans call for building 24 temples on the kind of that would have looked a little bit like the Kirtland Temple. So the design would have been 24 Kirtland temples. And so they wouldn't have all been in the one spot, in the 2.5 acres that the Church of Christ temple lot owns. Some of those 24 temples, a whole portion of them actually would have been underneath the foundation of Community of Christ Temple. So it is in that same exact kind of what you might call the temple square or two temple squares in the center of Zion. That's where the Community of Christ Temple is built. The same thing, the Church of Christ Temple lot, they also are there. And then the LDS Church also owns a portion of the original temple property from Edward Partridge.
Yeah, they don't have a really good spot. The Salt Lake guys, they're kind of third string in this battle.
This is one place where the places, you know, the LDS Church kind of didn't win out are Kirtland and Independence. Nauvoo, the LDS Church has the really good spot, right? So
yeah, and you know, I was going to bring this up before, but. My understanding is there were two expeditions by the LDS Church, and there may have been more, to sort of reclaim both people and artifacts. And the first one, if I'm not mistaken, was by a young Joseph F. Smith, who was sent back by the Brethren to go try to – and that's when they went and contacted Oliver Cowdery and Martin Harris, and they tried to buy up some of this property. And then the second big push was by, of course, Wilford Wood, who was the church's buying agent in the early part of the 20th century and went and just bought everything they possibly could. And that's how the church owns, you know, Sharon, Vermont and you know, the New York sites and all that sort of stuff.
Joseph F., you meant to David Whitmer. So Oliver Cowdery was dead.
I'm sorry.
But exactly. So, you know, he went to David Whitmer and he tried to, for example, get a hold of the manuscript of the Book of Mormon and the seer stones and those kind of things, and David Whitmer wouldn't give them to him. So those ended up in the archives of Community of Christ.
Oh, you have the seer stone.
Well, we have Whitmer's and Cowdery's seer stone. Not, you know, so like Joseph has a seer stone, and that's in the LDS archives.
Yeah, and the Wood Museum has one too.
But the Book of Mormon, the printer's manuscript is in the Community of Christ archives, along with the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible. There are portions of the original manuscript that came from the cornerstone of the Nauvoo House, and those are in the Salt Lake archives.
Okay, so these two expeditions didn't convince you all to sell out, I guess.
Well, we didn't own all the, you know, we didn't own that money. I mean, it depends on what, you know, so.
If there was any attempt, you know, for the Kirtland Temple or for the temple lot, it probably would have been taken place by one of those two fellows. But like we pointed out before, they were unsuccessful.
Yeah, there wouldn't have been a lot of, by the time Wilford Wood even by either of those expeditions, it was too late for Kirtland Temple. So right. By then it was very important to, you know, our LDS church had restored it and it held general conferences there. It was very important, to the church. And so there was no possibility for, by the time of either of those expeditions, to get a hold of the temple.
So. Okay. Since we're talking about the early days, let's talk a little bit about Emma. One of the things that, you know, I was always taught, of course, the church has had a mixed relationship with Emma since Brigham Young sort of wanted to expunge her from the history and literally was burning books. So one of the rumors is that Emma never really joined with the reorganized church. She might go if she were dragged, but she never joined.
Right. So that's false. So essentially what the confusion here is, so it was really important to RLDS rhetoric to say, so the RLDS church had a really big, point of saying constantly, we are the original church. So the reorganized church is the same church that Joseph Smith founded. It's just been reorganized and it's in continuity. The LDS church is the offshoot. And so, and how do we know, what's a sign that the LDS church is the offshoot? Because when Brigham Young, brought everybody into Utah, he made everybody get rebaptized when they entered. And so they had to enter a new church. And so that rebaptism for us on our end, you know, there was a perfectly different reason from Brigham Young's, you know, his perspective about why people needed to get rebaptized and what rebaptism was all about. From the RLDS rhetoric, that was because the LDS had founded a different Brighamite church, a different Brigham Young church. So in keeping with that idea, it was incredibly important that nobody in the RLDS church got rebaptized, right? So Emma, who had been baptized in the original church, of course she was not rebaptized into the RLDS church because the RLDS church is the original church. Likewise, Joseph III was not baptized into the RLDS church because it is the original church. In other words, that's why that was done that way. But Emma, definitely went, to the meetings. In other words, she went to the conference where her son was ordained, prophet of the church. She later, took up again her, role, that she'd had earlier in the early church of selecting hymns for the hymnal. And she, was in charge of the project for making the first, hymnal on the reorganization. And she was a member of the congregation in Nauvoo. So she was definitely part of the RLDS church. She didn't get baptized into it because nobody got baptized into it who was a member of the original church.
Okay, and you know, one of the other rumors is that she was really hell-bent on making sure her son was the prophet, and that's what caused her schism with Young.
And then, so that's not the case at all either. So Emma actually supported William Marx to be the head of the church. So she believed that the head of the presiding high council, which had charge over the church in Nauvoo and then in all of the organized stakes, should be the successor to Joseph and not Brigham Young, who was the head of the traveling high council, who was in charge of all the missionary work and in charge of the church in the branches outside of organized stakes. So those two had sort of a co-equal kind of position under the first presidency. And Emma's position was William Marx, who's her friend and also political ally, and as opposed to Brigham Young, who is her enemy and political enemy, whatever, that William Marx should be the one of those two in a rather co-equal positions. Marx's position was, no, in fact, both of us have inferior claims to Sidney Rigdon, who, after all, is a member of the first presidency, the only surviving member of the first presidency, and his claim is the valid claim. And so essentially Emma's position gets rolled up into Marx's support of Sidney Rigdon. And then in the showdown between Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young, Sidney Rigdon obviously lost to Brigham Young. And so at that point, Emma was definitely not interested in having her son take over. She just had her husband killed from being president of this church. She was, in fact, hesitant always to have her son take over. She supported him when he did it, but she did not encourage him to do it. She'd had a lot of misery in her life by having the president of her church be president of the church be in her family. And she was definitely, you know, worried for her son to do that. So.
All right, as long as we're talking about Emma, let's talk about polygamy. So the other accusation, and this is a long historic battle, is that the Reorganized Church denied that Joseph ever practiced polygamy and that it was a practice introduced by Brigham.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. So the Community of Christ, the RLDS Church, long took as a article of faith, essentially, that Brigham Young was the source of polygamy. And so at a certain point, especially in the middle of the 20th century, in the early 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, under, under Joseph's grandsons, when Joseph's grandsons become the prophets of the church. So when Fred M. Smith and Israel A. Smith, who are Joseph and Emma's son, Joseph III's sons, when they become presidents of the church, they especially are, they especially believe statements from their father, and then written statements from their grandfather, Joseph Jr., who definitely denied that he practiced polygamy in public. He constantly denied that he was doing it.
Right.
But this was a ruse. And Emma also denied that he was doing it. And this was the same exact ruse, frankly, that Joseph was doing. It was the policy of the church to deny, in Joseph's lifetime, to deny that this was going on. And Emma maintained that policy. So this was the thing, though, that then by the time that, that came down to, the grandsons, they just believed that. And they told that, to the membership as kind of an article of faith. And so the result of that was when, RLDS historians in the 1960s, when the new Mormon history starts happening, when RLDS historians, you know, look at the evidence, and the evidence is very clear that Joseph Jr. is the origin of, polygamy and Mormonism. This was a major, and caused for major heartbreak in the church. So the church was, you know, in a lot of ways devastated that this central core belief, you know, proved false. I mean, it's really right up there with if LDS historians had believed, you know, the evidence about, you know, I don't know, all that, that there's no possibility that the Book of Mormon is literal, that there's no laminate DNA, that the translation of the Book of Abraham is not, you know, that doesn't have, you know, that there's nothing related to the Egyptian, the hieroglyphics. You know, those kind of things. The difference is that, the historians and the church and church authorities ultimately conclude, okay, what we've had as an article of faith is in fact wrong. And right. so that's been the, you know, it's been kind of been an ongoing struggle as people have had to deal with that reality.
So it is possible for churches to repent from past false teachings.
Yes. It's hard. People should take note. I'll tell you. I can even tell you on that one. So I've written with Barb Walden and David Howlett a very brief little illustrated history called Community of Christ in Illustrated History. And on page – and this was published by the church, by Herald House, which is essentially Community of Christ's version of Deseret Book. And on page 13, which for many older members is kind of like the infamous page 13 of the book, we very frankly state that Joseph Smith is the origin of polygamy, and that's really the first time that that's happened that frankly in that, you know, without any a lot of hedging and ho-humming words in a Community of Christ publication. And it's not been easy. So a lot of members will come up to Barb or me and say, you know, old, just sweet old ladies who said, you know, I believed for my whole life that that wasn't true, you know, and, you know, when you're telling, you know, so it, you know, it's still hard for people. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. So as long as we're talking about changing doctrines, let's talk about, I think it was 1984, wasn't it? When women were ordained with the priesthood. Now, the rumor is that, of course, the Community of Christ in its early days, maybe it still is, was patrilineal. Just like in the LDS, in the Salt Lake LDS branch, the patriarch of the church, followed the same pattern. So the rumor is that they ran out of Smiths. There were no more boys to take the lead.
Right. Yeah. So that's, yeah, there's a bunch of complicated things. So like you say, the one thing is that there's this idea that there is lineal priesthood in Mormonism. And so the big model for that was the presiding patriarch or the presiding evangelist. It was that, both terms were used in the early church, presiding evangelist and presiding patriarch. Nowadays, Community of Christ, we say presiding evangelist, but and you don't have a presiding patriarch anymore, or you do.
The bugger guy just won't die. I know. We're trying to get rid of him.
On emeritus status since whatever, 1977 or something like that. So he's a Smith, right? So he is one of Hiram's descendants, in the LDS church. So in the Community of Christ, when the reorganization was happening, when all of these different divided Latter-day Saints in the middle, in the Midwest, were coming together, one of the things that brought them back together was they were rallying. They're like, they want to come back to that old church that they knew, that wonderful spirit that they felt in Kirtland and everything like that. And the banner for them to come back was, here's Joseph's son, right? So here's the new Joseph Smith, Joseph Smith III. And so for a lot of them, the idea that, that was that the prophet, the position of prophet then was being passed down, by lineage. But just like, when people ask, well, why don't you, I mean, the whole reason why the schism happened between, the people out in Utah and the people in Midwest, it happened was because of polygamy. But you're not practicing polygamy now, right? So what's the answer? Why doesn't the LDS Church practice polygamy now? The answer is continuing revelation usually, right? You don't say, well, we buckled to political pressure, right? But anyway, you say, because of continuing revelation. In other words, a later prophet suspended the practice. And so in the exact same way, Joseph III is also a prophet of the Community of Christ. He actually was president of the church for whatever it is, 50 years, a very long time. And he had a much more, unlike his father, left a much more specific counsel to the church about how the succession should happen. And he did not say that the succession should happen via lineage. So at that point, the system was open to change. However, in the next several presidents of the church were, in fact, Joseph III's sons. So they were his sons up until the 70s, and then it was his youngest, the last one of them, his son, so therefore his grandson, the great-grandson of the president, was the last Smith who was president of the church. And that's Wallace B. Smith, who is still alive now. He's emeritus president of Community of Christ. So our presidents don't serve necessarily till death. They can retire and become emeritus president or emeritus prophet. In the same way, the apostles don't serve until death; they retire when they're too old really to serve actively. And so the way the succession happened, there were plenty of Smiths. So yes, Wallace B. has daughters, but there are lots and lots of male Smiths in the church. The Smith family has not had any problems with being non-prolific. There are hundreds of Smith descendants, and lots of them are in Community of Christ. I have very good friends who are direct descendants of, Joseph Smith. And so there would be no problem, including there's leading church leaders, professors at the church's university and things like that who are Smith descendants. So it was not a lack of Smith descendants. It was, an additional revelation from Wallace B., which is to say, or an insight, which is there's no reason that a church in the later 20th century and now the 21st century should be ruled by some kind of, primogeniture. That's just not what God was calling the church to do. So.
Okay. So, the women received the priesthood. And I guess one of the rumors, is that really divided the church and sent it down a path to destruction.
Right. So there were lots and lots of, there are lots and lots of things that culminate in the revelation that, that ends the ban on women having priesthood. So that was the last one for a lot of people in the church. A lot of people had drawn that as their line in the sand. But it, in the reality of it is that both churches, the LDS Church and the Community of Christ, have faced some very serious challenges in the post-World War II era, where we have this change where you go from being where the primarily everybody in the church is working class, they're not college educated, to like this transformation that occurs in America in general, where everybody goes to college. There develops, for example, the new Mormon history. So there's this incredible challenge to traditional Mormon truth claims. The idea that the Book of Mormon is literal, a literal history, that, you know, all of the different, you know, any number of these ideas that have, you know, that have emerged and the challenges that emerged, all of the questions of, you know, of the traditional stories, the way they've been told in Sunday school, as opposed to when we now have professional history and we look back and we have the actual sources, you know, the challenge. Anyway, so both churches are faced with the challenge of the new Mormon history, and then also in general with this is also true in Christianity in general. But the Community of Christ responds very differently than the LDS Church does. And so what ends up happening is in the Community of Christ is the leaders are responsive to the new information. And so they are not, they don't just close down and say, no, we are going to just say that, you know, we'll continue with the statements that we've always made and these kinds of things, even if the evidence contradicts that. Rather, they said, look, this is what the evidence says, and this is therefore, you know, so we need to adapt in light of the evidence, and we still have something that is true and of value to us, but we're not going to just put our head in the sand and say this evidence is false, and we'll just, you know, put our hands in our ear, fingers in our ears, and say na 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 until it goes away. And so the result of that was there were all kinds of changes from the 60s on that anticipate, that lead up to the end of the ban on women having priesthood. And so for conservatives in the church, there were all kinds of things that had already, you know, riled everybody too much to the, you know, so for example, you'd mentioned the lineal priesthood for the presiding evangelist, presiding patriarch. Mm-hmm. That was one of the very first things to go, you know, in like, I think it was something like 1958, they called a presiding evangelist in the RLDS Church who was the leading, theologian at the church's university, as opposed to a Smith descendant, you know. And so it went from there, you know. And so there were all kinds, you know, and so change and change and change. And so at a certain point, conservatives said, this is our line in the sand. And when the revelation came, to extend priesthood to women and then also to build the temple, it's the same exact section 156 in the, Community of Christ DNC. When that came about and it became a very contentious general conference, or world conference is what Community of Christ calls those now, and that did result in a schism. And so a minority, but a very vocal and also a very zealous and active minority, left the church, and so it was maybe whatever it is, 20% of the membership. And so those people ended up, we call them restorationists, but it's essentially conservative RLDS people who are now either in their own independent RLDS branches, which are not part of Community of Christ, or they've joined into their own kind of restoration churches, like the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day
Saints. So how organized are they? Do they have a quorum of the 12 and a presidency?
So by and large, most of them don't. It's not easy to do once you, so what ends up happening is their first idea and their first, concept of what they're going to do is kind of like what the Mormon fundamentalists do. So people may not be aware, but when the polygamists break off from the LDS Church in the early 20th century, over the changes that the LDS Church makes. They specifically do not form churches. So this idea that there's an FLDS Church now, that's a new innovation. By and large, fundamentalist Mormons, they don't consider themselves to be their own church. They consider the LDS Church to be the church. They just consider the LDS Church to be in apostasy. And they're waiting until God purifies the church and brings it back. And in the meantime, they're maintaining the kingdom and the priesthood, right? And so in the exact same way, the restorationists maintained themselves in branches with the belief that God was going to bring Community of Christ, you know, back to being really conservative again. And at a certain point that, you know, you realize that isn't going to happen. And so some fundamentalist Mormons are still holding out for the time when the LDS Church re-embraces polygamy, which is not going to happen. Some conservative restorationists may well be holding out for Community of Christ to reverse course, which it also will not do. But some of them haven't. And so some of them, and I don't want to compare, because actually there's completely different kind of organizations. But anyway, so one of the organized groups of restorationists is called the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They do have a prophet president. They do have a first presidency, Quorum of the Twelve, and an organized structure. And their president is a Smith. So he's one of the descendants of Fred M. Smith, who is the grandson of Fred M. Smith, who was the grandson of Joseph Jr.
Okay. The Community of Christ, there's lots of different rumors about this, but what is the relationship with the Book of Mormon?
The Book of Mormon is canonized scripture, one of the standard standard works of the Community of Christ.
So you haven't thrown it out?
Haven't thrown it out. In fact, I'm going to next month I'm actually a stake, essentially, a mission center in mission stakes in what are effectively like stakes in Community of Christ are now called mission centers. The one in Colorado is going to have me come out to teach a college course in a retreat in restoration scripture, which includes a whole big section, obviously, on the Book of Mormon. So. But yeah, no, we definitely, the Book of Mormon is scripture. At my congregation in downtown Toronto, we generally, the Book of Mormon is quoted every week. That isn't true in all Community of Christ congregations because all of the different congregations are completely different. Some people may not think too much of the Book of Mormon, but some people might think, you know, very highly of it, and people have all kinds of different views. So there's the entire spectrum in the church from people who are historical literalists who think that the Book of Mormon was a literal history and that each of the characters in it are actual historical personages to people who would be like me who think it's, you know, scripture that is allegorical, that is not history, but that it is still like, for example, in the same context as like the Book of Job or the parts of Genesis, which are also not historical, but are scripture. And then that goes to all the way to the other end of the spectrum to people who are really upset with the Book of Mormon and who don't want to, you know, won't quote from it and are busily emphasizing other books of scripture, probably. But it's canonized in the church, so it's scripture.
Okay. I think a related one, would be the name change. I think a lot of, Brighamites, I think
right.
That's basically a sign of apostasy, as if they already didn't say that, but, So what's with the name change? What was it just to become more Protestant-like, or what's going on there?
Oh yeah, all the Protestants said, "You guys have got to. If you don't change your name, we're just not going to give you the Protestant card."
You guys have the Protestant seal of approval now, right? You're in the club.
We do have the Protestant seal of approval, actually. But anyway, okay, it's not Protestant. But anyway, with the Christian seal of approval we got. But anyway, let's go back before we get into that. The name change. So the original name of the church when it was organized in 1830 was Church of Christ. So why did we change the name? So, I mean, it's apostasy that we changed the name, or at least a lot of people in the early church really thought it was apostasy. The name got changed in 1834 to Church of the Latter-day Saints. And so a lot of members had been told the doctrine, the only true church, one of the ways you can tell that the only true church of Christ is that it is called the Church of Christ. And then suddenly, 4 years later, the church's name gets changed to Church of the Latter-day Saints. Well, that made a lot of people in the church say, well, this means that we're in apostasy, that this isn't the church anymore. And that's why lots and lots of early members who end up, frankly, end up, you know, having their own smaller Latter-day Saint churches, or they don't want to be called Latter-day Saint churches because they reject the term Latter-day Saints. So we mentioned the Temple-Lot Church. The Temple-Lot Church is called the Church of Christ. We call it the Temple-Lot Church or the Church of Christ Temple-Lot in order to differentiate it from all the other churches that are called Church of Christ. But there are lots and lots and lots of churches, Mormon churches, that are called Church of Christ because it goes back to that original name. Well, anyway, by 1838, Joseph Smith, the concession essentially was, okay, we got it. We got it, people. Everybody, we'll compromise here. We'll now call it the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So we'll have both, you know? And so they end up having this name that is horrible. It's so awkward and long. And so this is not a great, I mean, everybody has to know that this is not the best branding, that anybody has ever come up with. And so then in order to so when we reorganized, in 1860, the church was called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And you will even see on branches of the RLDS Church in the 1920s in the Midwest, it says Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on it. That name is the name of the church because that was the name established by Revelation in 1838. But what ends up happening is that people think of, when they hear that name, they think of the church in Utah. And so, was added for legal reasons so that, to protect, church property from the anti-polygamy statutes of the late 19th century, and also for branding reasons to differentiate from the Utah church. The church ended up legally incorporating as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And if you thought that the first name was bad, then this is even a more horrible name, you know? So
Now so for clarity's sake, is yours hyphen small d, no hyphen big d?
All of them. Okay. So yeah. So all of the, this is so complicated, right? So in the original church, there was no way, the spelling was not, standardized. So at once in the Times and Seasons, I've seen one issue of the Times and Seasons where Latter Day is done all four possible ways. So it is Latter dash little d, Latter dash big d, Latter space no dash little d, Latter space, you know, big d. You know, one issue. So it's completely unstandardized. But the standardization that happens out in Utah is dash little d. And then the Midwest, it standardizes to space big d. And so all of the other churches besides Brighamite churches and even the FLDS church has space big D. I think everybody else is the other way. And so it's Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter space capital D Bay Saints. And that was what it was called. So that was a terrible name. We recognized it for a whole long time. The church was going, you know, is trying to figure out some way to, what do you want to call yourselves in order to make, you know, to do something that, has something better for your identity and everything like that. So in the 70s, they were trying very hard to write saints really big. So it was the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Church. And so it was trying to be called, they were trying for a while to kind of brand it under the title the Saints Church. But the problem with saints is it's one thing to call the people who got persecuted and, you know, and kicked out of Missouri the saints. But it's another thing if you want to go around and call yourself the saints. You know, no one ever felt comfortable calling themselves a saint. It's one thing to call, you know, the persecuted people saints. And so that was problematic. And so essentially, the idea of Community of Christ as a name is to have a positive name, that's that reflects the identity and heritage of the church. So, the original name being Church of Christ, but then that takes the core values of the church, which are obviously is the initial basis, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then on top of that, then the value that has really been important to the movement the whole time, which is building community. And so, recognizing that, that's the name change. And I'd say that the real advantage to the name change, I think it's like, so I've been in the process of immigrating to Canada. So Canada up to the 1960s had a kind of a negative identity where their identity was, we're not the U.S. They didn't have an identity. What is the Canada's identity other than we're not the U.S.? you know, and I think it didn't have one. And I think it was, you know, it was resource extraction or whatever it was. And they didn't have, and they didn't have a flag. They had a kind of a British ensign. So there's the British flag in the corner, and it could have been like anything from, you know, Australia's flag or any, all those British flags look exactly the same. But then they came up with this maple leaf flag, you know, as a kind of an identity logo, a positive identity. And now anywhere you go and you see, you know, in Europe or whatever, you see that Canadian emblem on it, back of everybody's backpack. Canadians have developed a very positive identity. It's not just down to the logo, you know, but the logo is part of why that happened, which is not just, we're not the U.S. So, and so, it's a progressive North American country, and it has its own central identity that isn't only saying, you know, we reorganized version of somebody else. You know, that's not what we're saying anymore. So instead, we want to turn inward and say, look, this is what's positive about us, not what we're not. So that's the change.
So that leads to the, you know, the church famously has declared that you can't call, this is the Salt Lake branch, you can't call them Mormons, but you can't call anybody else Mormons either. So do the Community of Christ, do you all consider yourselves Mormons? Do you like the term Mormon? What's your relationship with that term?
Well, historically, we did use it. So historically, like in the 19th century, we used it, but you have to, you know, so originally nobody liked that. Joseph Smith didn't like it. Nobody, you know, whenever they used it in the early church, they put quotes around it. And I can even see in LDS publications all the way up through the, you know, it's a love-hate relationship. On the one hand, it's a brand that everybody gets, and everybody outside of the church knows it, and they know the word Mormon, and it's something that, as opposed to Church of Christ, which could mean anything, or Latter-day Saint, which is sort of horribly long and awkward, or LDS, which is, you know, acronym, euphemistic, or whatever, all those things. So it's the one word that really, you know, as a kind of a gut word that really works in the whole brand. You don't call yourself this is the Mormon Expression podcast. It's not the, you know, Latter-day something, what, you know, long, long, long euphemism podcast. Yeah,
no one wants the term Mormon, so I took it. I happily own it.
But so what I would say is that there's, for all, everybody in the movement, there's been a long-standing kind of love-hate relationship with this term. And even like you mentioned, the LDS Church, on the one hand, wants to trademark the thing. And sometimes it's in the end of a commercials from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons or whatever, you know, or I'm a Mormon campaign. So in other words, sometimes it's embraced, sometimes it isn't. We would be at this point in the big isn't phase. So in other words, there were the people that embraced the term or were still using it in quotes and things like that all through the 19th century. At this point, Community of Christ doesn't use it. I've heard there's older people like Bill Russell, I know, who's a good friend of mine who's a professor at Graceland. He sometimes calls himself a reorganized Mormon. but this is kind of just to be silly, right? So it isn't, but it is, and there's like a phrases like, Alma Blair, who's another historian, called the RLDS Church, moderate Mormons, right? So that was the idea, you know, people who didn't get halfway to Zion or halfway to Utah, you know, or something like that. but the answer is no, it's not used. But on the trademark issue, other churches do use it. So fundamentalist Mormons definitely call themselves Mormons. Strangite Mormons definitely call themselves Mormons. Mormon doesn't refer solely to the LDS Church. So I would say it's part of the whole. I call the whole thing synonymously either the Restoration, the Latter-day Saint movement, or Mormonism. And so Community of Christ is a church, a denomination within the broader category of Mormonism, I would say. But members will recoil if you ask old line RLDS person, they'll recoil at being called Mormon. They wouldn't want to be called Mormon. So,
well, John, I've covered most of the ones that I know about. Is there any we've left out?
Well, one of them, and we talked about it a little bit. You mentioned it, so we hit on this, which is the RLDS Church has, you know, jettisoned this and that belief and or the Book of Mormon in order to join the National Council of Churches and become Protestants, right? And so, the big thing is, you know, we're just a Protestant church, and there's a lot of things that that feed into that. So one of them, for example, is in our congregations, in which have historically been called branches, not wards. A ward is a development that happened kind of late in Nauvoo and then especially crossing the plains and then in Salt Lake, calling congregations wards. So the earlier word is branches, and in our branches or congregations, our presiding elders we're not the leaders of these congregations aren't bishops, because that again is a crossing the plains and then a Utah development, where the bishop, who has always been the financial officer of the church, became the head of the congregation, when before in the early church the head of the congregation had been called a pastor, or the presiding, you know, essentially the branch president, but the title was pastor. And if you go to the Articles of Faith, one of the offices that's listed is pastor. And that's obviously not in the LDS Church now, but when we talk about our branch presidents, or what would be for the Mormon equivalent of bishops, we have bishops, but bishops are financial officers in the stakes, or in the presiding bishopric. The leaders are pastors, and so immediately everyone's like, oh, they're just Protestants with these paid ministers or whatever. But the pastor, for example, in my congregation is just a lay person who's exactly like a bishop in a way, in a Mormon ward. In other words, he's a guy who happens to be a high priest who has been called to be the presiding elder of the branch, which is to say the pastor. And so it's not because it's a paid function. In this particular case, I mean, there is a difference in how the calling works, because in our congregations, the congregation would be called like a ward conference, and and that has actual voting, and you vote on who the officers are. And so the people are inspired themselves in the congregation who should be called to be the head of the congregation, not the person who is for the next year. And so it's a little bit different in that way, but it isn't that it's Protestant. Now there are some congregations that are big enough that they have, that they are able to, then have the person who is otherwise a lay minister to, you know, be able to work full time, and the congregation itself is able to remunerate them. That does happen in Community of Christ, but it isn't the same as it's a little different therefore from a Mormon church, but obviously there are some Mormon officials that are also paid, but it's based on the congregation. So that's a difference, and that's something that seems so very Protestant. So anyway, that was a muddied explanation on that one. But the other one is, okay, so the Community of Christ has joined a ecumenical organization called the National Council of Churches. And this is an American ecumenical Christian group, which primarily consists of the big liberal denominations and then all kinds of tiny token freaky little churches. So, which we might say. So for example, you're going to have like the liberal, Lutherans, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalian church, and then it's going to be something like the Uniate Bulgarian church in America or whatever it is. So these kind of churches that are brought in because liberals love to have all that kind of diversity. And so you can imagine which kind of church we fall under, whether we're the giant mainline Protestant church or we're one of these little interesting churches that they're happy to have with us in terms of diversity. So for us, it's important because ecumenicalism is part of our long tradition that we've had of of having peace as the motto of the church and of promoting peace and of bringing everybody together. But in the course of joining this organization, one of the myths that has been propagated is, well, so that we could join it, we had to give up the Book of Mormon, or we had to give up the Doctrine and Covenants. And the answer is that we did not. So, those are canonized scripture in the church. The National Council of Churches, admitted the Community of Christ and also recognizes the Community of Christ as Christian and all those kinds of things without making those kind of concessions. So those concessions were not made.
So, you say it's a liberal church, and this might be a sort of a good place to finish up. What are the key, you know, briefly, the key theological differences in terms of practice between the Salt Lake Branch? Now, we know the Salt Lake Branch is very authoritarian, what you described, not so much so with the Community of Christ. But what are the main differences? We've talked about women and the priesthood. What are the other big theological chasm there?
Well, so there's a lot. So I would say that it has an almost entirely, such an entirely different feel and structure to it that it's almost hard to get your hands around it when you just walk immediately from one to the other. So in the LDS Church, there's a real idea that there is a, everybody should all be kind of on the same page. So that there is sort of an interpretation. You know, there could be, I mean, whether or not Mormon doctrine is in print, there's an idea about that there's an actual specific church answer to things, and people who may well be, let's say, progressive and who may be opposed to this or that thing or practice within the church, they want it to change or whatever, but they understand that they are off the correct page with everybody else. In Community of Christ, the situation is very different. When we're saying that we also are from a restoration tradition where we say we have no creed, but that really, that's very meaningful in the Community of Christ tradition where, everybody is very able to have very, 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 very different beliefs, within the whole church, of course, but within individual congregations. And the idea of it is that we are coming together and we share values of building community and, of respect for each other and unity of diversity, worth of all persons, these kind of things. But in terms of, let's say, I described it a little bit with the Book of Mormon, you can have everything, and we do, for example, in my congregation, we have everything from people who are very literal Book of Mormon believers to people who definitely believe it's a 19th century document that Joseph Smith wrote. And that's true all across the board, for, scripture in general. So there'll be people probably who believe in, I presume in the literal flood maybe, and that, and an ark and all that kind of thing. And then there are a lot of people who, have gone through and have read the scholarship on that and who have decided that this is a symbolic story and this kind of thing. So there can really be the entire spectrum of those kind of beliefs. Which I think that's a hallmark of a progressive denomination. Yeah. And then it's just an emphasis on some sort of progressive issues, one of which we've really been working on, which are peace and social justice issues. And, most recently, that we've been really trying to tackle and are tackling is, having full participation in every level for, GLBT, gay and lesbian, bisexual, transsexual members. So for example, we are about to have in Canada, where I'm not quite living, but about to be living, we'll have a national conference soon in the church, which should make all kinds of new rules within the church about, for example, how the church will not only recognize but allowed to be perform gay marriages in the church and that kind of thing.
It's fascinating to me that the same foundation, a simple idea that Joseph introduced of not having a creed, led in two really opposite ways. For the Salt Lake branch, not having a creed, not having a fixed doctrine, has given rise to a very authoritarian central structure, where because we don't have a creed to compare what the brethren say, the brethren are sort of free and have a blank check to dictate what has to be done with no accountability. You know, they can say something for 50 years and immediately stop, and there's no recourse. There's no calling them out or anything like that. And then compare that to going the other branch, the other line with having no creed, to say we're welcoming of different ideas, of different lifestyles. This is sort of a peaceful community. And from that same foundation, and it, to me, I look at both ideas and neither of them are really contradictory with what Joseph Smith said, but in a way they both are. you know, and I guess it was in the White Horse Prophecy, but Joseph is credited of saying that the second coming won't happen until the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church, the schism heals and they come back together. And maybe it's the second coming won't happen until the Community of Christ and the Salt Lake branch heal and they all come back together in middle ground.
Well, we don't have to worry about it coming back then.
Probably not.
Well, I mean, it's not just us holding out. It's those Eastern Orthodox guys.
Well, John, this has been fascinating. I'm always fascinated to learn more about the Community of Christ. And I think it is telling, you know, not to, of course, the Brighamite branch being the most wealthiest and most powerful, you know, the kind of the bully, so I can pick on them a little bit. But it's sort of telling on what stories they tell, on how they sort of bully and pick on, you know, the smaller neighbor, the Community of Christ, with the rumors that they let fly. I think it doesn't point much at what we think about the Community of Christ. It points more about what we say about ourselves.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, that there's this one about buying temples. I mean, I just think in a way, it's really, maybe if the listeners will like turn it around and say, okay, you know, it's hard to do because the church is so rich, right? but anyway, okay. So those malls go bankrupt and the church is in trouble. And so they have to sell the Salt Lake Temple. Under what circumstances are you selling the Salt Lake Temple?
Yeah.
What do you have to do? In other words, what has to happen that you're selling the Salt Lake Temple or what, you know, it's offensive, right?
There's one that's a little bit more patronizing. We didn't actually even talk about, which is the idea that the Salt Lake Church is really this big brother that secretly pays money to keep this thing alive and is funding it, you know, in this sort of, we're magnanimous. And let me tell you, that's not the way the church works. When they gave money to the Cathedral of the Madeleine in downtown, you bet they had a press conference and they did it with a big, big old giant check and that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, no, I can also confirm that, that the LDS Church doesn't give money to support Kirtland Temple in any way. It isn't sending money, didn't give money to build the Independence Temple. I guess if the people want to give money, I don't know. We haven't said no, but nobody said, hey, we just got the $50 million check for you for nothing. Just have it. We don't care. I don't know. We spent $6 billion on the mall and we just figured, hey, no, I don't know.
All right. Well, John. Excuse me. Thanks again for coming. If people have questions for you, I mean, there's things we might not have covered. Where can they contact you? On this or other stuff?
Can you post? I'll follow your thread and I'll answer on the thread. How about that?
Excellent. Great. So if you have any other questions or any other rumors about the Reorganized Church, hit us up at MormonExpression.com and we'll be there on the thread. This episode was directed and produced by myself and edited by Rich Rasmussen. Mormon Expression is a production of Whitefield's Educational Foundation. If you find this to be valuable, please consider a subscription or a donation today. Well, John, thanks again. We'll have to have you back again soon.
Thank you so very much. I loved it.